Our second case of the day is United States ex rel Parks versus Alpharma Incorporated. Mr. Johnston?
Yes.
You have the podium, sir.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Joe Johnston. I represent Appellant Deborah Parks. In this case, this is an appeal from a grant of motion from summary judgment by the District Court of Maryland. The court granted motion for summary judgment on Mrs. Parks' whistleblower claim as part of the False Claims Act. Today I'm going to be arguing that the court made error with respect to the elements of notice and causation. First of all, with respect to the notice element, Mrs. Parks did set forth sufficient evidence to establish a material issue of fact as to whether Alpharma was on notice of her protected activity. And in granting, in holding in favor of Alpharma on that issue, the district court made factual conclusions, which was improper on a motion for summary judgment. Second, with respect to the causation elements, the court essentially, although Mrs. Parks did set forth evidence to establish prima facie causation, or in other words, a causal connection between her protected activity and her termination, the court essentially disregarded that. And she also set forth evidence to establish pretext with respect to Alpharma's proffered non-retaliatory reason for the termination. And that was error as well. So for that reason, the district court erred in granting summary judgment. There's also the issue of the cross appeal. We contend that Alpharma has waived its ability to file an appeal of the court's holding with respect to that Mrs. Parks did in fact engage in protected activity. And I will address that today as well. Mrs. Parks, there are a lot of facts at issue in this case. I don't have time to go through all the facts. But what the facts show, when viewed in a light...
So the cross appeal is just on the first prong.
Exactly, right? The protected activity prong.
Okay.
The facts show that when viewed in a light most favorable to Mrs. Parks, which is the proper standard of motion for summary judgment, it shows that during the time period when she worked at Alpharma from approximately 2002 to 2006, she became extremely successful as a sales representative. Within a relatively short period of time, of approximately 3 years, she became the number one sales representative in the country. What the facts also show, however, is that Mrs. Parks had been tasked with certain activities, certain illegal fraudulent activities that she became uncomfortable with.
What are the illegal fraudulent activities that she was tasked with?
She was tasked with the responsibility of preparing a slide presentation for Dr. Kaplan. After Dr. Kaplan gave that presentation, she started receiving telephone calls.
Is that an illegal activity?
Right.
The slide presentation in of itself. The slide presentation in of itself was not illegal. However, what Mrs. Parks complained about was when, after that presentation, she started getting questions, emails from other sales representatives about this conversion method. She realized they didn't understand the conversion method, and she wanted to rectify that, to try to explain it better. When she requested that there be a company-wide conference call to do that, that request was rejected. And it's at that time when she realized these sales representatives were going into the field describing this conversion method. They didn't understand the conversion method. They were therefore promoting, marketing, an off-label use of Kadian.
Assuming that's true, that sequence of events that you've described, if you back up, it seems that Ms. Parks was actively involved in promoting Dr. Kaplan, and that at most she thought that there was some confusion. She would have no way to know. I mean, there's nothing that suggests that Alpharma, that I'm aware of, was engaged in promoting off-label marketing, or more significantly, that it would involve a government expenditure, which is a False Claims Act protection. So I guess we still haven't quite gotten to my question about the illegal fraudulent activity for purposes of a False Claims Act retaliation claim.
Okay. Your Honor, with respect to the off-label marketing, Mrs. Parks, in approximately November, December 2005.
Can we start? You wanted to start with the slide.
Okay.
So that's, if you want to start there, that would be great.
Well, that's, there was a dinner meeting with Dr. Kaplan about this slide presentation, and Mrs. Parks was assigned to help assist prepare a slide presentation at this Atlanta, Georgia conference. Mrs. Parks did that under the supervision of the Director of Regulatory Affairs at Alpharma when she did that. But the point I'm trying to make is that what the facts show in the case is that up until that point, she hadn't started reporting anything fraudulent within the company. It wasn't until after that Atlanta presentation that she started being, quote unquote, inundated with telephone calls questions because sales representatives didn't understand this conversion method. And it's at that time that she went and spoke to Craig LaFay, other supervisors within the company.
And the company's fraudulent activity for purposes of the False Claims Act was what?
Was in allowing sales representatives to go into the field and market this conversion method when they didn't understand it. It was that the improper
fraud for purposes of the False Claims Act?
It is, Your Honor, because
the False Claims Act, I thought the False Claims Act would be triggered by the False Claims Act claim would be triggered by an improper disbursement.
Yes.
What the court suggested, as I recall, is it might be awful. It might be illegal, or it might be impermissible to market for off-label purposes, but that's still not necessarily a False Claims Act claim.
Okay, Your Honor, the off-label marketing. If a sales representative goes into a physician's office and markets a drug off-label, the physician in turn prescribes that drug. That is a false claim. Because it is an illegal.
No, I don't think that's correct. I mean, it may violate the FDA, but what's the false claim?
It's a claim that the doctor otherwise would not have submitted unless the sales representative had promoted, marketed an off-label use of the drug.
I don't think that's a correct statement of the law under the False Claims Act. Are you sure do you have any support for that? Could you help me with that?
Well, there's the Park versus Davis case where that goes into length as to talking about off-label marketing and how off-label marketing from the standpoint of a sales representative can amount to a false claim.
If it leads to an attempt to seek improper government reimbursement, yes. And I'm sorry, I don't want to take up all your time.
Okay.
On this.
Well, Your Honor, I would just ask that you look at the Park Davis case.
I'm familiar with the Park Davis case. Thank you.
The major flaw in the court's ruling with respect to notice was that it disregarded the evidence that Mrs. Park set forth that although she did assist with preparing the slide presentation, it wasn't until after that she discovered there was wrongdoing, there was fraudulent activity going on, and that's when she complained about it. Okay.
Fraudulent activity about what?
About sales representatives promoting an off-label use of Kadian. And it was off-label in that the sales representatives.
She complained about it to whom?
She complained about it to Craig LaFay, who was the director of sales at the time. She complained
in writing?
Not in writing. She had a person-to-person conference about that.
She tell him that you're going to end up in a viable False Claims Act case.
Yes, potentially.
She told him that. She said you're going to end up in a False Claims Act case.
She did not.
For false billing the United States government.
She did not. She said this is off-label marketing by sales representatives. And in that context of a sales representative going to the director of sales and saying that other sales representatives are marketing an off-label use in a drug when they're in the field, that is synonymous with fraudulent activity.
So, and you're saying that's sufficient to have provided Alpharma with notice?
Yes.
Meet the second prong?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying that off-label marketing equals False Claims Act
in this context, Your Honor, yes.
That they're the equivalent of one another.
Yes, in the context of a sales representative, yes.
Without any request involved for government reimbursement?
Well, eventually, the idea is that once in promoting an off-label use of the drug,
you are necessarily implicating a government reimbursement?
Yes, Your Honor, because of Medicaid, Medicare patients.
Is there any evidence to that effect in this case, or that's just your testimony?
Evidence of specific claims being.
Do you have an expert or somebody that ties that together?
Or
how do you establish that?
Or evidence of an impermissible claim against for government reimbursement?
Well, Your Honor, we don't have any expert specifically to testify on that
issue. Or any specific evidence of an impermissible request for government reimbursement.
Well, Your Honor, it's implicit, I believe, in submitting a...
Implicit?
It's implicit if a sales representative is going into a doctor's office to promote an off-label use, it will in turn result in a false claim submitted to the United States government. Your Honors, the issue with the off-label marketing, that's not the only activity that Mrs. Parks
complained
about.
There's no evidence in this record that shows that to that effect.
To the effect of a doctor going and submitting a claim as a result of off-label marketing?
Yes.
No.
And you don't have a case that says that?
Other than the Park Davis case, no, not specifically. That
you say it says that specifically?
In that they discuss how when a sales...
You say we don't have anything other than the Park Davis case that says it specifically, so you're saying it says it specifically.
Okay. It's that what the Park Davis says, it says is that off-label marketing of a drug by a sales representative is illegal, and it can amount to a False Claims Act.
With respect to the cost results of the Cadian conversion, that's another allegation. And your argument is that Alpharma was burying the cost results. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But the abstract was created by a third party with the help of Dr. Kaplan. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how was Alpharma burying the cost results?
Because they hired that company to prepare, essentially ghostwrite that abstract for Dr. Kaplan.
And so that's burying the cost result. And
yes.
Burying the cost result is fraudulent and illegal under the False Claims Act.
It's fraudulent in that these abstracts were used to promote Cadian, to get Cadian on formularies that were used for Medicaid recipients. And as a result of that, it was a false promotion of Cadian as not having negative pharmacoeconomic results. Effects, and that in turn that was a false representation of Cadian, which in turn resulted in false claims submitted to the United States government. Your Honor, I just want to touch quickly on the causation and the pretext elements, but just to summarize on notice, I believe that Mrs. Parks has set forth sufficient evidence to establish at least a material issue of fact as to whether Alpharma was on notice of her protected activity.
That's the second prong.
That's the second prong, yes.
And the District Judge Bennett gave you the first prong.
Yes, he did.
And then you got this third prong.
We have the third prong, the causation element, and this court has recognized that very little evidence of causal connection is required to establish a prima facie case in a retaliation case. Here we have not only temporal proximity between Mrs. Parks' protected activity, her internal complaints about fraudulent and false activity by Alpharma.
Well, let's go back to notice, because don't you have to get to that before you get to causation?
We do, Your Honor.
And how was Alpharma aware of activity that might, which would have a nexus to a False Claims Act claim?
By her complaining of off-label marketing, that is activity that could in turn lead to a False Claims Act. By her complaining about the...
Well, doesn't, as I understood our case law, there has to be some nexus to a potential False Claims Act claim of which the employer must be aware.
Yes. And the potential False Claim Act in this case was the off-label marketing by Alpharma sales representatives. In the marketing of the Kaplan switch study, or the Kaplan method. The causation... There's temporal proximity between the protected activity and her termination. There's also the retaliatory animus of Mrs. Park's superiors by Mr. Peter Hill and by other superiors.
Retaliating for what?
Retaliating to Mrs. Park's protected activity. They were calling her derogatory comments. They were treating her harshly.
You're saying they knew that she was reporting them to the...
Yes, because...
She was reporting for false claims?
Was
Tom case pending then?
Your Honor, she was objecting to activity, fraudulent activity within the government, and they were retaliating against her by treating her harshly as a result of that.
And during that same time period, they were also giving her awards and merit pay increases.
Yes, correct? They were, Your Honor. She was a very successful sales representative, but it all came...
And she was making all kinds of money off this off-label marketing you're
talking
about.
Yes, and so was Al Farma, Your Honor.
So Al Farma's making money off of it. So she's getting rich off of this off-label marketing that you say she's complaining about.
No, Your Honor. She was complaining. She came to a point where she realized this is improper. She objected, and that's when the harsh conduct by her employer started.
So there came a point. There was a point at which she was an innocent participant in this illegal activity that you say, and then it came and at that point she became a whistleblower.
Yes, Your
Honor. The activity. What's the date of the change from being the innocent participant to being the whistleblower?
Well, I think it was in approximately October of 2005.
Specifically.
Okay, October of 2005.
Under this evidence, you say it was October 2005?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Burke? Pleased to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I am Lindsay Burke on behalf of Al Farma, Inc. Ms. Parks has not met her burden as to any of the three elements of a False Claims Act retaliation case: protected activity, notice, or causation, and she must satisfy all three elements in order to survive summary judgment.
Now, Judge Bennett ruled against you on that first one.
That's correct, he did, and we did not need to cross-appeal. We did not cross-appeal, nor did we need to cross-appeal in order to put forward that argument at this level.
Okay, someone mentioned a cross-appeal on the first prong. There is no cross-appeal.
We were not required to cross-appeal. Yes.
The argument, I took it to be that there had to be a specific cross-appeal for you to challenge that component.
I believe that is the argument.
That's the argument.
But,
okay, so you're challenging it without a cross-appeal?
Correct.
All right.
Which, under the case law in this circuit, we can argue in support of any evidence in the record, even arguments specifically rejected by the district court, without the necessity of cross appeal.
You can argue that there's an alternative way for us to affirm or something.
That's correct. This court may affirm.
We can affirm by ruling that he was wrong on the first element.
Yes, you may. You may affirm on any grounds you wish. That's correct. All three of the elements of a False Claims Act case really go to the question.
You willing to spend all your time on that one, on that first prong, and just go right on and rest on that?
I'm not planning to spend all of my time on the issue of protected conduct.
Okay.
All three of the elements really go to the question of motive. What motivated Al Farma to terminate Ms. Parks in July 2006? Because the company terminated Ms. Parks for reasons having nothing to do with internal complaints that she may have made to the company about Al Farma's marketing or promotional practices, the decision of the district court should be affirmed. Before I do go to the issue of protected conduct, though, I want to make an important point about notice. The evidence is undisputed here that Ms. Parks did not use the words fraudulent, illegal, or false claims in making any alleged complaints to the company. She says that she used the word off-label. Now, specific magic words are not required. We recognize that. But what the company must know is that the plaintiff is investigating fraud. The leading case on what constitutes notice in this circuit is the Eberhardt case. What the Eberhardt case really stands for is that context matters. This is what the district court focused on. In order to determine whether an employer is put on notice by what an employee is saying or doing, it's necessary to look at the whole picture of the plaintiff's employment and examine the context in which statements were made. The context here is crucial, and it's one of the most compelling grounds for affirming the district court's decision. First, as I think you noted, off-label is a commonly used word in the pharmaceutical industry. It is not synonymous with the word fraudulent, as Ms. Parks argues. Second, Ms. Parks, again,
what
as...
What does it mean in the pharmaceutical industry, off-label?
Off-label uses of a drug. A drug has many uses, okay? A doctor may prescribe the drug for any uses, whether or not the label that comes with the drug includes those uses. However, the label that comes with the drug specifies the uses that the FDA has approved the drug for. Now, the FDA is not going to interfere with the practice of medicine. So if a doctor decides that a drug is useful for another use that's not in the label, the doctor may prescribe it in that fashion. What is illegal under the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act is for a pharmaceutical company to promote the drug for a use that is not specified in the label. That would be an off-label promotion. So the sales representatives need to understand the differences between an off-label use and an on-label use, because they need to know that they cannot promote it for uses that are not in the label. And if they get questions from doctors about off-label uses, they need to know where to send those questions. They have medical consultants that work for the pharmaceutical company, and those questions have to be sent there. So every day, a pharmaceutical company and a sales representative have to make decisions. They have to be educated. They have to understand, this is on-label, this is off-label. You can say this, you can't say that. We're going to train you and teach you about off-label uses, but you can't use those when you go into a sales meeting. So this is common everyday parlance in the pharmaceutical industry. Just because a sales representative says the word does not mean that the company is going to be put on notice. This is particularly true because, as you pointed out, Ms. Parks was an aggressive and really relentless cheerleader for Dr. Kaplan and for this company. Let's talk about this Kaplan conversion method that my colleague focused on. This is the only alleged scheme that she says she actually used the word off-label at the time. She characterizes some other things that she did as complaining about off-label, but this is the only one where she used the word at the time while she was employed. What's at issue here is a presentation that Dr. Kaplan gave to the sales representatives at Alpharma, and it included slides about how he personally converted these some of his patients to Kadian. She contends that his conversion method, it sounds like what she's contending now, is that his conversion method was off-label when it wasn't fully understood.
He was converting them from one pain medication to another one,
yes,
right?
That's correct.
For this one.
Yes, from Oxycontin to Kadian. The record shows, as you pointed out, Ms. Parks enthusiastically promoted Dr. Kaplan to the company to conduct the study that gave rise to the presentation. She helped arrange for him to give the presentation. She actually participated in putting the slide presentation together. And then after the presentation, she was concerned about sales representatives' confusion. She followed up to make sure that it was clearly understood. She herself distributed the text of certain slides to the sales representatives. And when we asked her about this at deposition, she testified, I wanted to clear up the confusion. I was concerned that nobody understood it, and I wanted to be able to ensure that the reps did understand the conversion because it was a serious matter and could endanger a patient's safety. She herself characterized her complaints as concerns about patient safety, not as concerns about fraud on the government. So based on this context, this is her current characterization that what she was really complaining about was fraud is simply not consistent. And there is no evidence on which a reasonable jury could rely to find that what she was really concerned about was fraud and that the company should have been on notice that that was her chief concern. The same is true for all of the alleged complaints. Given the context that she was an aggressive promoter of Dr. Kaplan, she was an aggressive promoter and cheerleader for the company and the drug, the things
did
she said...
continued to promote Dr. Kaplan after October 2005?
Yes. The Coventry presentation was in February 2006. That was another presentation that she arranged for him to give and that she drafted, helped draft the presentation that he actually gave.
Was she present when he gave it?
Yes, she was. So... given all of this context, whether she may have used the word off-label...
At that time, did she stand up and say this is fraud?
No, she did
related
not.
And off-label and we shouldn't be doing this?
No, she did not. She did not even use the word off-label with regard to that presentation at the time. She now characterizes her objections to that presentation as having been objections that that presentation was off-label. But in fact, she cites two emails that she sent regarding the Coventry presentation. These are excerpted in the briefs, and she says in her brief, I was objecting to the off-label message proposed by Mr. Anderson. But if you actually look at what the emails say, she says, the main issues we've been having with Coventry are BID reimbursement, that's twice a day reimbursement. If it were me, I would have the Royal slide, a plasma graph, clinical info. But I am not a managed market rep, so perhaps I am off base. Then, when she testified about this and was asked, what did you mean when you said that? She said, I was saying that a better presentation would be on pharmacologic differences and the scientific aspect. Again, she herself is characterizing her concerns as strategy concerns, differences over how they could be successful with Coventry. This is not consistent with her current characterization that she was complaining about fraud, and there is simply no way the company could have been on notice at the time that what she was actually complaining about was fraud.
What about the cost results?
So the allegation there is that Kaplan's study, which was the study that she promoted Dr. Kaplan to the company to do, resulted in some what she describes as pharmacoeconomic results. She says that those
were expensive to the conversion. It was expensive because there would be times when the patient would be paying for a lot of morphine.
Yes, she's saying that switching the patients to Kadian cost more money than keeping them on their current drug, and that Alpharma didn't include this information in a published abstract that was submitted to an academic conference. That is her allegation. First of all, there is no, I think you pointed this out, Judge Duncan, there is absolutely no evidence that results were actually buried. No one ever told her results were buried. And she's produced no evidence that results were tabulated and then hidden away somewhere. What she says is that they weren't included on an abstract that was submitted to a pain conference. I submit to you, how you get from that to a False Claims Act is an important question, because as you pointed out, this is a False Claims Act case. And what matters here is fraud on the government in the payment of a claim. There is no nexus between putting results or not putting results in an abstract that's submitted to a pain conference and a false claim. And moreover, there is no evidence that she herself had a good faith belief that fraud would result. The False Claims Act protects employees who are opposing government fraud in the payment of false claims. And all of there are five alleged schemes. With regard to all of them, there is hardly any nexus, if any, between the conduct that was occurring and an actual claim submitted to the government. She doesn't even write it out, let alone argue that she observed conduct that would relate or that could have resulted in a false claim. Now, the Park Davis case, I just want to point out, is a case that was what they're referencing is the motion to dismiss stage, where the District of Massachusetts, for the first time, this was the first time in 2002, that a judge considered the theory that if a pharmaceutical company promoted a drug in a systematic way for an off-label use, and that promotion of the drug resulted in prescriptions written, and those prescriptions were reimbursed by government entities such as Medicaid, then maybe you would have a False Claims Act.
Right. The allegation involved the submission of claims for off-label usage to the government for reimbursement.
That's correct. And importantly, again, that was considered, what was at least alleged in that complaint, was that it was a systematic company strategic message that they were going to promote this drug off-label. They were going to engage in a scheme, and that was going to boost their profits. And those off-label prescriptions were going to result in false claims. We don't have any of that here, any of that. At the very best, some people may have been confused, and they may have, according to the plaintiff, they may have been confused, and so they may have said the wrong thing. However, this is very important. There's absolutely no evidence in the record that any sales representative actually described the conversion method to a doctor. None. So you don't even get to the part where the doctor prescribes the medication on that basis, and then that prescription is reimbursed by the federal government. Now, again, she doesn't have to prove up the entire claim, but she has to have a reasonable belief in order to be opposing fraud. If she doesn't have if the conduct is not even occurring in her experience, then she can't have a reasonable belief that fraud may be afoot or that the company may be liable.
How about the argument with respect to the honorarium that she was asked to provide to Dr. Kaplan for the Coventry presentation?
Well, that argument, what she's saying there is that he was not on the company's speakers bureau, and so he wasn't supposed to be giving certain kinds of presentations. Now, that is an internal company policy, that a doctor needs to be on a speaker's bureau, and that there needs to be that's how he gets reimbursed. There's no evidence beyond her testimony that she was asked to pay him with her own American Express card. But even if she had been, that's maybe a violation of company policy. That is not a violation a federal law that would result in a false claim. That's another example of how the conduct that she complains about, there's no nexus between that conduct and an actual false claim submitted to the government. If I could turn to causation. Ms. Parks was terminated because she was engaging in disruptive conduct that was undermining the morale of her sales team and her managers. The deficiencies in plaintiff's evidence are most striking in this with regard to causation. It is undisputed in the record that Ms. Parks' conduct was the subject of multiple complaints to management. What particularly concerned the company, and what may not have come through in our briefs, were complaints that Ms. Parks was spreading a rumor that her African-American sales manager was having an affair with an African-American sales representative on the basis of what seemed to be nothing more than the fact that they were both black. This concerned the company very much. The sales manager was a married man with two children. The sales representative was a single mother. So this conduct was investigated, and while it was investigated, many other complaints came in about Ms. Parks' conduct. At the time of the investigation, they met with Ms. Parks. She denied the behavior, and her counsel sent a letter to the company complaining that actually it was Ms. Parks who was being victimized by her colleagues and that these were false rumors that people were saying she was spreading. And at the time, neither Ms. Parks nor her counsel said that what was happening was a result of complaints she was making about the company's marketing and sales activities. So at the time, the company decided not to terminate her. She was a high-performing sales representative, and they decided that they would give her a stern warning. And the decision not to terminate her was essentially conditioned on her keeping the investigation confidential and keeping the underlying allegations confidential. The record is very clear. She did not do that. At least it was reported to Ms. Donahue within days that she did not do that. In fact, it was reported to Ms. Donahue that within days she went out to salespeople in her region and said, "What have you heard about me? Have you ever heard me say this? Have you reported me for this reason?" She really inflamed the situation further. And the record reflects, again, it was reported to Ms. Donahue that Sheila Swanson, the African-American sales representative, consulted an attorney, and that Pete Hill, the African-American supervisor, said that he was starting to feel harassed because of all of this dust-up and conversation about what she had said and who was spreading rumors about whom. So the company was very concerned about this, and they decided to terminate her, even though she was a very high-performing sales representative. The company had to consider how it would look if they did not act very strictly with regard to this high-performing sales representative who they had warned and investigated. And it might look to other sales representatives like she was being treated leniently, or worse, it may look that like the company was trying to protect her because she was a high-performing sales representative. They made the decision to terminate. That decision was a reasonable business decision. It's fully supported by the evidence in the record. And under the law in this circuit, the court will not second-guess the prudence of a reasonable business decision that's supported by the evidence. That's the DeJarnett case. So,
what was the date of the termination?
She was terminated on July 24th, 2006. The evidence, again, clearly establishes that her conduct was the subject of numerous complaints by company employees to Ms. Donahue. It was the subject of the meeting held with her. It was the reason communicated to her at the time of her termination, and it has always been the reason that Alpharma has set forth for her termination in litigation with Ms. Parks. Contrast this with the total absence of any evidence in the record that the decision makers considered internal complaints that she may have been making about the company's conduct with regard to marketing or promotion of the drug. Moreover, statements by the plaintiff herself corroborate that this was the company's motive in terminating her. She filed an entirely separate lawsuit after she filed this lawsuit, in which she alleged that her colleagues reported to the company that she was spreading rumors, the company believed those rumors, and they terminated her for it. So her testimony is that she said this in deposition in this case, she absolutely believes the accuracy of the allegations in the defamation complaint. Therefore, she is on record in agreement with the company's stated motivation for terminating her, that she was terminated because of complaints that others were making about her
activities. And we can take judicial notice of that, or is that in this record?
It is in this record. Ms. Parks also has not produced probative evidence on which a jury could rely to find that Alfarma's stated reasons for terminating her was pretextual. Her evidence consists chiefly of her own testimony and affidavit, much of which is conclusory or based on hearsay. She's denied the behavior under this court's decisions in Holland and Tinsley. That doesn't matter. It's the perception of the decision maker that matters. And there is no question, and it's undisputed, that Ms. Donahue believed that she deserved to be fired. She points to a discrepancy in certain dates in Ms. Donahue's affidavit. We submit that that is immaterial because you could take out that information altogether with regard to the merit increase, and it would not change really the nature or the volume of the complaints that were made to Ms. Donahue, nor would it change the complaints about the violating the confidentiality of the investigation. And again, Ms. Parks is actually not pointed to any, she's never alleged that Ms. Donahue or Ms. Halperin knew anything about any complaints or that anyone told them about any complaints. So she has never alleged that they themselves harbored any retaliatory animus. If the court has no further questions, I will conclude by asking this court to affirm the decision of the district court because Ms. Parks has not been a burden as to any of the three required elements of a False Claims Act case. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnston.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to touch really briefly on the notice issue, you asked before about how a complaint of off-label marketing could eventually result in a false claim. I think the court can take judicial notice that anyone over the age of 65 is required to register with Medicare. Any person who's employed, unemployed, no longer working after the age of 65 is getting health insurance through Medicare. At the same time, anyone under a certain income bracket may be receiving Medicaid as well. With respect to this issue with the Kaplan conversion method, Mrs. Parks was getting complaints from sales representatives all over the country. It wasn't just in her district. So it's based on that, it is implicit that if she's complaining about off-label marketing about this sales presentation, it reasonably should have been understood as a possible key Tom action could have been reasonably understood based upon those complaints of off-label marketing.
But the only case you have on that is that Park Davis case.
Well, I have another case, Your Honor. There's
another one now.
Okay.
Well, good.
There's the case Washington Legal Foundation versus Henney, 202 F3rd 331. That stands for the proposition that any drug that has been subject of off-label marketing is has been misbranded and it's illegal to sell.
I noticed that Park Davis case decision was abrogated.
It was abrogated on other grounds, Your Honor, not with respect to its discussion of off-label marketing.
So you think it's still good law?
I do believe it is good.
That part of it, your part of it, is still good law.
Yes, Your Honor.
But even though it's a district court in Massachusetts.
Yes, you obviously don't have to follow it, but it is good law. The Eberhardt standard, I believe it's a slightly higher standard, notice standard, than applies in this case, because in Eberhardt that applied to an employee who was tasked with the specific job of overseeing contract provisions, of overseeing fraud. That was not applicable here with Mrs. Parks. I just want to touch, counsel, she described Mrs. Parks as being a relentless cheerleader, as being enthusiastically promoting the presentation of Dr. Kaplan. I submit, Your Honor, those are factual conclusions. Those are arguments to make to a jury, and that's precisely what the district court did in this case. It adopted those factual conclusions that counsel has proffered in this case and ruling against Mrs. Parks on the notice issue. Now, with respect to...
You don't dispute, though, the fact that she was the primary beneficiary of his prescription of Cadian and that she promoted him to the company. I mean, those are undisputed facts, are they not?
No, they're not. They are disputed facts, Your Honor. She was actually specifically tasked with this clinical switch study. She was initially assigned to work with Dr. Kaplan. There's an email from Dr. Royal.
But didn't she promote the presentation by
no.
Dr. Kaplan?
All she did is she assisted in the preparation of that presentation. And then afterwards, she was getting questions from sales representatives, and she tried to provide additional information to explain the conversion method so that sales representatives could understand it. I want to go to causation, if that's okay. I believe that there is temporal proximity between her protected activity and her termination. In addition to that, there was recurring retaliatory animus before her termination, which is it's enough to meet the relatively low burden of establishing causal connection. And with respect to pretext, I think counsel's representation, her description of the error, the inconsistency, the discrepancy that's in the affidavit and the written notes of Mrs. Donahue is not, it's not irrelevant. It is significant. I believe it calls the entire file that Alpharma has on this case regarding Mrs. Parks into question. And I believe that Holland versus Washington Homes case is a distinguishable case from this case, because in there, the plaintiff, he could only deny the allegations that were made against him. Here, Mrs. Parks not only denies the allegations, but there's this glaring discrepancy in the affidavit of Regina Donahue and in her handwritten notes, which calls into question this entire initial investigation into her complaints about the so-called merit increase. Finally, with respect to this state law claim, counsel has, first of all, I think it's important to remember that pleadings can be inconsistent. It's okay to plead one thing in a state court case and plead something different in a federal case. And the two lawsuits aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. And with that, Your Honor, we conclude and we ask that the court reverse and remand the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Alpharma Incorporated.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll come down and greet counsel.